All right, so we spent about 15, 20 minutes last time on the argument from mind. The argument structure is essentially a best explanation argument for consciousness. And it's a kind of design argument. The argument is that we possess an immaterial substance that is in a relationship with our bodies. It's called interactive substance dualism. Now, we went through what is mind, what is matter. I argued that substance dualism is the biblical view. Some people will try to deny this and say that you can account for the human person biblically merely in terms of physical properties, physical substances and properties. I argue briefly in On Jesus, this is not the case. J.P. Moreland affirms in his book that you're reading it's not the case, and he's got an entire book on it called Body and Soul that shows that it is the biblical view and it's philosophically credible, much more credible than any form of physicalism. Now, if you're a psychology major, even if you had psychology at a Christian college, many times psychology is taught as if the person were exhaustively physical. That is, you are a product of your genetic background and your enculturation, period. So there's really no self that is an immaterial substance. And sadly, some Christians have even argued this, claiming that the Bible does not really commit us to any kind of a substance dualism. And I think that's not true. Remember I said apologetics is living dangerously. And where the Bible commits you to a belief, no matter how unpopular it is, you should defend it as best you can. Now, some things, I think, are legitimately up for grabs, such as the age of the earth and the age of the universe. We talked about that. I don't think the nature of the person is one of those things that's negotiable biblically. For one thing, we have references to the afterlife in Philippians 1 and, I believe, 2 Corinthians 5, to be absent from the bodies, to be present with the Lord. That's got to be an immaterial state. You're absent from the body, you're present with the Lord before the resurrection. There is an intermediate state. It's also referred to in the book of Revelation, the souls of those who were slain underneath the altar crying out, "How long, O Lord, until you avenge our deaths?" There's a lot of biblical evidence for an intermediary immaterial state, and there's a lot of biblical evidence for the existence of the soul in this state in connection with the body. So, we don't want to negotiate that away. Now, people think this is a liability, but it really isn't. In fact, if we can say that materialism has a very hard time accounting for the mind, the existence of consciousness, put it that way, and that theism better accounts for the existence of consciousness, then we have a pretty strong argument. Now, let me pick this up on page 6, Problems with Physicalism as a Worldview. The first thing to consider is, why even attempt to explain consciousness merely in physical terms? It seems you need some kind of background information or background theories to point you in that direction. Now, if our versions of the design and the cosmological argument, and we'll also give moral and religious experience arguments, are solid arguments, the basic motivation for that dissipates. Because it's frankly counterintuitive. You can easily imagine yourself existing without a body. You can do a kind of conceptual experiment. It seems at least possible. And as I said, the vast majority of philosophers and religious thinkers throughout the ages have assumed that consciousness is real and is not reducible to physical properties. This program of trying to reduce consciousness to material properties is not really new, because you have even pre-Socratics who are materialists. But this sort of thorough attempt, which is fueled on by artificial, spurred on and fueled by artificial intelligence, is more of a modern movement. But all the problems with physicalism remain, and all the strengths of dualism remain. So we've got good evidence for things that are non-material, such as propositions, I mentioned this last time, numbers, values, laws of logic, universals, and so on. We have some evidence from the world of near-death experiences. I'll just make reference to this. I don't have time to detail it. There are some pretty solid reports of people clinically dying leaving their bodies and then reporting on things that they could not have known in their bodies because they're clinically dead. I researched this from my book, Deceived by the Light. There's another book by Habermas and Moreland called Beyond Death that gives a similar argument. And there are other Christian thinkers that have looked at this. And we're not getting into the strange world of endorsing the occult. I'm just saying that there's evidence that the soul can exist apart from the body for at least a short period of time. I wouldn't rest my whole argument on that, but that's part of the argument. But there are essential problems with mind-body physicalism, and principally it stems from the law of identity. All right, the law of identity says basically that X is X, that something possesses only the properties it possesses. So if you have something that possesses properties X and Y and something else X, Y, and Z, they cannot be identical. This is so metaphysically simple. But then you look at consciousness, and you think of the various aspects of consciousness, and you ask, is this the same as a collection of physical states? All right? This is the argument from the distinctiveness, the difference, the incommensurability between mental and physical states, or discrepant properties. Think of private access. You have access to thoughts that no one else does. And no one, through any kind of physical observation, no matter how exhaustive, will know some things that you know. Private access. You know it by introspection. I can't know anything about you by introspection. I can only know things about me through introspection. Yes?
So you think of any other mechanical things away from
No, I don't think that's true. I mean, when you take the computer in to be fixed, they try to figure out what part's malfunctioning. When you take the car in, you try to figure out what part is malfunctioning. You don't do an interview. You know, what kind of pain do you have? What kind of sensation do you have? It's all about the function of the parts. Now, if you report to a physician a pain that you have, that's subjective. But that gives them an indication that something objective is wrong. But if they see something objectively wrong with your knee, they do not see the pain. They see the physical states that cause the pain, but they do not see the pain. The pain is a first-person introspective quality. Okay? And don't worry about Vulcan mind melds and things like that here, all right? Just rein in your imagination a little bit. But see, even if there could be... No, let's go with it. Even if there could be a Vulcan mind meld, it's not physical. It's like the mental reality of one person is connecting to the mental reality of another person. It's not that somehow by some very careful scrutiny of physical properties in their relationships that you know the inner state. It's by the mind penetrating the mind. See, it makes sense in an abstract way. Yes? Sure, if there is such a thing as telepathy, it's not a physical connection. Okay? So private access and incorrigibility, there are some states that are incorrigible, meaning they have to be what they are. If you think you exist, that's an incorrigible reality. Descartes got that right with the cogito. You have first-person subjectivity or the existence of what's called qualia, not reducible to third-person states. That is the feeling of something, the experience of something. You know, you can describe this book in terms of all of its physical properties, but the seeing of the book is the qualia. It's the feltness. It's the texture of the subject encountering something through consciousness. Now, that is surrounded by all kinds of physical states, but it is not reducible to them. It's different from them. You have the reality of secondary qualities. You can take this in two ways. You can say that secondary qualities like color and taste are not real, but we do experience them. So if they're not real and we experience them, what kind of experience is that? You can't account for it with respect to chemistry and physics. But if your phenomenology wants to say that they are real, that we do perceive something that's real, you still can't really capture them in a physical and chemical description. So whatever they are, they seem to be in the mind in a way that they're not clearly in the object. So that's saying there's something in the mind that is not in objects. Again, discrepant properties. You're talking about two different kinds of things. Or intentionality, or what is sometimes called ofness or aboutness. If I am thinking about this piano, there's a relationship between my mental state and the piano, but it's not a physical thing. There's no physical thing connecting me to the piano. I'm thinking about a piano. Or if I'm thinking about a Thelonious Monk piano solo, that's an about state of mind. It's called intentional. I'm thinking about things that don't exist, like vampires or pro-life Democrats at high office. It's still an intentional state. Or John Kerry thinking straight about religion and politics. I'll come back to that. So intentionality doesn't seem capturable, if I can use that term, by material states. Or personal identity. This is very important. Remember, on a materialist reading, you are a collection of physical states that has existed over a period of time. You're just basically a matrix of inputs and outputs, causes and effects, all material. So from the time you were conceived till now, there's quite a bit of rotation in your physical cells. You've changed quite a bit. But there's no substance that holds it all together, that holds you together. You're just a collection. You're an aggregation of physical states. Now, how can an aggregation of physical states within quite a bit of flux account for things like memory? Where I can remember when I got my finger stuck in a clothes cart when I was 5 years old. I remember that. I have a scar, too. How could that be if it's just one collection of states and it's gone through so many changes and rearrangements? It's almost an entirely different aggregation now. I mean, there's some causal continuity, but there's no real substantival continuity. But a soul can provide for that, you see. Even the very sense of a self in observations. Let's say if you walk around the room, you have various angles on the class. You have various experiences. Well, what makes all those experiences your experience and not just a collection of discrepant experiences? What is the unifying factor? Well, the dualist says the soul. The soul is perceiving X, Y, and Z and so on and relating it to itself. It's not a mere collection of appearances or a collection of states. Also, there's the reality of morality, responsibility, and punishment. On material grounds, how can we really understand moral accountability? Because we're nothing but meat machines. And the direction that some people are going in now is that, look, this idea of a unified self is really a holdover from religion and from substance dualism. You are a collection of subsystems that seems to be a unified self, but really is not. All right? Richard Dawkins is giving this argument. Pinker is giving this argument now. You're a collection of subsystems cobbled together through evolution, which really has no unification materially or spiritually, because there is no spirit, there is no mind. Now, if that's the case, how do you hold a collection, an aggregation, accountable for murder? Or how do you praise it for doing some heroic action? Yes?
In using this argument, would we have to necessarily explain how mental states and physical states interact? Sometimes I hear that. You can't explain how they interact.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the arguments against dualism, is that how can two very different things interact. Well, the real question is, how can two things that are so different be identical? I mean, if they cannot be identical, then there's really no difficulty with them interacting. That's the only choice you have left. Moreover, we can think of very different sorts of things that interact in a causal nexus. I can't think of any right now because I didn't bring my examples with me. But when you think of causation, there are. Can anybody come up with something? Something very different from something that it causes? I've got a whole list at home which I didn't bring with me. Yes. Okay. Yeah, a solid battery creating something that's very different from itself, an electronic charge. Now, we have things like that at our disposal. I don't have my list with me. But look, if they can't be identical, they have to interact. Yes?
Could you turn an argument on its head? And for example, a psychologist who says that they can therefore affect the soul through chemistry or through surgery. And wouldn't that necessarily, again, it's not identical, I know. But because they can not only correlate one way, but they can be affected the other way, I could see that instead they're therefore saying that there must be some chemical way or some physical way to explain the soul if I can change, interact, contour the soul through chemicals and through surgery.
Well, I think that's just a non sequitur, because the thesis is substance dualism, which is interactive dualism. So the thesis is that they do interact. So you're not telling me anything new. The problem is reducing one to the other. Now, in the history of philosophy, philosophers typically were more worried about the actual existence of matter than mind. That's shifted in the last 200 years, especially since Darwin. Now we have to justify mind, not justify matter. But the physical interacting with the immaterial is part of the thesis. Now, if you could reduce one to the other, that would be something else. But I don't think those explanations are reductive. They're just contextual. If you take this painkiller, your sense of pain will be decreased. All right? If you receive a blow to the head, you may lose some of your memory. But those are not identity statements. Those are one thing relating to another thing kinds of statements. Okay? But you hear it all the time. It was in the Pinker article I handed out. It's really a terrible argument. So, when you think of morality, responsibility, and punishment, you are assuming a unified self that is a moral actor. And it's very difficult to assume that on materialist grounds. Moreover, mind-body physicalism seems to be self-refuting because it can't be supported rationally. Intentionality is required for rationality. If you're thinking through an argument, let's say a modus ponens argument or modus tollens argument, you're thinking about the argument. That's an internal, subjective, first-person, rational state. Now, if intentionality cannot be explained materialistically, it cannot be reduced to material components, then rationality is out the window. Now, interestingly, there are some thinkers called eliminativists, such as the Churchlands, who want to do that. Daniel Dennett as well. They say talk about consciousness and intentionality is really what they call folk psychology. And we have to get rid of it just the way we got rid of folk cosmology. Well, once you get rid of it, you have no more philosophy. You have no more thinking. You've just muted yourself. Tim, do you have a comment? Well, I think, frankly, J.P. Moreland deals with the best arguments both ways. If you can master his basic argument, you'll be in pretty good shape. Some of it is promissory. That is, we just need to wait until science discovers the nature of consciousness, until science shows that it's reducible to material particles and fields of force. We just have to wait. Be patient. It's a promissory note. You might call it the materialism of the gaps. They accuse us of God of the gaps. It's the materialism of the gaps. Just wait. We'll find this esoteric property somehow. All right, we'll wait and see what happens, but I think that's a category mistake. It's not something that empirical observation, physical description, will ever capture, even in principle. So I think the only way to go is the way of the eliminativists. And they end up eliminating themselves. Because to write books, You have to have intentionality and rationality and responsibility. And you have to have propositions to interpret text. They don't believe in propositions because they don't believe in anything outside the material realm. For the mind to think rationally, you have to have immaterial states. Both in yourself, you have to be an immaterial mind, and you need immaterial states out there like propositions and laws of logic. Okay? We need rational insight for rationality. We need a continuity of personal identity for rationality. So if you're working on your next paper for many, many hours, which you need to do, as you probably already know, you need to be the same person at the first hour as the 20th hour in order to have any intellectual development in the paper. You need a continuity of personal identity. Now, that's difficult to establish on materialistic grounds, as we've already argued, and J.P. Moreland argues very powerfully. All right, so we've argued that there is a mind that is a substance that is distinct from the body. It's not just that the body has immaterial properties, but that we have an immaterial substance. Why do we need a substance and not merely properties? What's wrong with property dualism? You probably haven't heard this on talk radio this week, but what's wrong with property dualism metaphysically? Who had metaphysics last year? Jeremy? Right. Yeah, right. I mean, if consciousness is merely a property of the body and I lose consciousness for a while, who comes back? It couldn't be me. See, if it's merely a property, it's not a substance. It's not something enduring, right? So properties, the possession of properties change over time. So if consciousness is merely a property of the body, then it's hard to get any unity to the self. Moreover, it's difficult to understand the self as an immaterial substance that is an agent. You see, because properties don't cause things. They are caused, basically. Substances cause things. So it's not merely a property. We really need a substance. So if we've argued for the existence of mind as a substance in relationship to the body, interactive substance dualism, then how do we account for the existence of mind in the universe? Now, some people are dualists and are atheists. They're some kind of naturalist. Now, they're not a full-fledged physicalist, obviously, because they believe in an immaterial reality, immaterial substances. But they still may be naturalists. They don't believe in anything outside of the natural realm. The natural realm simply includes, somehow, immaterial substances. Now, how do you account for this? Well, first of all, there are emergent accounts, basically, that consciousness comes out of non-consciousness without a cause, or rather, without any original design. So it was just sort of a part of the nature of the universe for consciousness to emerge from non-consciousness, for mind to emerge from matter. Now, this is difficult to justify because it seems like you have something coming out of nothing without any design. Something as sophisticated and powerful as the mind, something that can grasp immaterial objects, can engage in logical reasoning, can have intentional states and so on, can be the way we access truths. All this merely emerged without any originating design. Seems like you're trying to get blood from a stone. Another account would be pantheism, which says that everything is mind. There is no matter. Or some kind of idealism. So mind is not a problem for this worldview at all. The universe is just brimming full of mind. It's nothing but mind. And things that you think are material are really immaterial. Well, the problem with that is that it seems like some things are material. They can be described nicely in a material way. They have properties that fit into material framework quite nicely. And we have mental properties which are distinct. So the dualist argument can be used against immaterialism as much as materialism. You're saying there are two substances in the universe, material and non-material. Now, another problem with pantheism, J.P. Moreland doesn't bring this out, is that most forms of pantheism are non-dualistic, or, to put it another way, monistic, meaning everything that is this universal spirit, this universal mind or consciousness. And it's all ultimately one. It's non-dual. If you've ever heard any of the pronouncements by Deepak Chopra or Gary Zukav or these public figures, or read anything by Neil Donald Walsh or these conversations with God, this is all pantheism. Everything is one, and the oneness is this universal impersonal consciousness. Okay, so we have a universal mind. We have mind. But we don't have individual minds. We only have a universal mind, which is the ultimate and the only true reality. We'll come back to this when we talk about Eastern pantheistic monism and New Age thought. But I want to plug it in here because some people say, you're right, materialism is false, pantheism is true. But pantheism cannot account for the existence, the reality of matter. Christian theism can. Materialism cannot account for the existence of mind. Christian theism can. And pantheism cannot account for intentionality or subject-object relationships because it's all one. There's no subject-object relationship. There's no me knowing the properties of this lectern or me knowing the properties of someone in this class, Jeremy having had metaphysics previously, so I could put him on the spot. That assumes an ontology that pantheism forbids, namely a plurality of substances and a plurality of different states, physical and non-physical. Because pantheism says that everything is one immaterial substance. Without any duality, without any plurality, without any diversity. And this comes through either directly or indirectly in a lot of contemporary discourse, especially the kind of spiritual guests one might see if one watched such things on the Oprah Winfrey Show, much of popular culture, movies, and so on. So pantheism is not going to work either. So it seems that the best explanation for the existence of an immaterial mind in human beings is a God who is immaterial and personal and rational and creative who brought it into existence. So we have like coming from like. Finite immaterial substances coming from an infinite or perfect immaterial substance, an unlimited substance, God, a personal being. And then the material part of us is that which God spoke into existence for the first time, which had never previously existed in any form. Genesis 1:1. So you can account for the matter and the mind. You don't have to reduce one to the other. You can deal with both and explain both given the existence of a creator God. I think that's a far better explanation than either some kind of naturalism or pantheism. And it's certainly a simpler, more parsimonious explanation than some kind of polytheism. You see how that argument works? I mean, maybe you would use this argument more defensively than offensively. You might use it more for negative apologetics than positive apologetics. Anytime someone's attempting to reduce the mind to material parts, material relationships, then you want to give that kind of an argument that, no, it's distinct from matter, the first-person access, the subjectivity, the intentionality, propositions, knowledge of truth, those kind of things. In fact, the very idea of truth is difficult to sustain on a materialistic ground. Because if a statement is true, it corresponds to reality. Well, the relationship of correspondence is really, I guess, a kind of intentional relationship. Because if I say there's exactly one piano on this riser, what makes it true? It's the correspondence between my statement and the thing that's there. Well, is the correspondence anything material? I mean, I used an acoustic blast. I have material parts that communicate it, but the proposition is immaterial. And the correspondence with the reality is immaterial. So the very idea of truth assumes non-material states. There's a great C.S. Lewis quote on that that I also left at home. I told you, it's a frazzled day. I didn't bring all my stuff with me, but I'll try to find that next time. All right, questions or comments on the argument from mind? Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but both are valuable. Because when God created human beings, he said they were very good. And they were a combination of the physical and spiritual. They're very good. So this view demeans neither matter nor mind. But it says that they are distinct. They are different from each other. And you cannot describe mental states in terms of physical states epistemologically, and you cannot reduce mental states to physical states ontologically. Okay? Yes? Which they don't have, yeah.
It's just so frustrating that I can present anything to this person, but it's consumed their life, and yet they've arrived at the wrong conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to go back to the doctrine of sin, the noetic effects of sin, that you can give perfectly good arguments that make good sense and people will not receive it. Either they won't understand it or they will understand it and they won't accept it. It's sort of the mystery of persons in a fallen world. No really significant argument of metaphysics convinces everybody. There are people that are idealists. They don't believe in the material world. There are people that are materialists who don't believe in an immaterial world. There are relativists who don't believe in moral absolutes. And they know the arguments on the other side. So that's no reason to throw up your hands and give up. That's a reason to try to keep giving the arguments in season and out of season as best you can with the best possible audience. Now, some people, you know, I doubt very seriously if I sat down with Daniel Dennett for 2 hours or Richard Dawkins or Steven Pinker, I could talk them out of it. But if I or someone more well-versed in this area, such as J.P. Moreland, could debate them for an hour and a half in front of an audience, I think that they would win. But it doesn't mean the other person would ever come around. I mean, sometimes in life, especially as you get older and you get more well-established, you make certain commitments to certain worldview principles. And to change at a later stage of life would be to completely undo your whole career. And a lot of people are not willing to do that. Now, that's an explanation that could be taken to mean it's ad hominem. You're just arguing against the person. But I'm trying to give you an explanation for why people don't get convinced when it seems like they should get convinced. I'm not substituting that for an argument. But there are all kinds of personal and interpersonal factors that go into apologetic discussions. Good arguments should be used. But good arguments that fall on bad soil will not be received. But people who are open, who are thinking, I mean, just this fellow, I'm sorry, your name again?
Craig.
Giving these arguments to people they had never heard before, and they at least say they're going to think about it. That's tremendous. And sometimes people who are deeply committed to a worldview do change. It does happen. So don't think that because you're not successful most of the time, or they're very brilliant people who hold other views, that your view is neither rational nor true. It can be rational and true, and for a lot of other reasons, people will not accept the viewpoint. There's also kind of a conservation of energy principle in apologetics. You know, I say try to speak the truth in season and out of season. Be ready. Be always ready. But sometimes it's time to move on. Sometimes people are just not serious, or they're very serious and you're not making any headway at all. And so you just need to stop. Okay, was there another hand I missed? Yes. Well, in a way you can, in a way you can't. What you can use is that sometimes pantheists will give arguments against materialism that are good arguments if they stand alone. And we could use similar arguments. But where we can't agree with them is where they give arguments that everything is mental, that everything is ultimately divine and unlimited. But a pantheist, in fact, I'll give you an example of this. Ken Wilber's book, A Brief History of Everything, has a pretty strong argument against Darwinism in it. But Ken Wilber's a pantheistic monist. He's not a Christian. But he gives a pretty good argument against natural selection being able to account for the vast diversity of the forms of life. He says you need something mental. You need some intelligence to account for all this. Now, in the final analysis, Ken Wilber's intelligence is an impersonal mind. That does not account for anything. But he gives a good negative argument against Darwinism. I think you can get arguments that are just as good, in fact, better in other sources. But so we're put it this way, where pantheists argue against materialism and where their arguments do not commit them intrinsically to pantheism, we could agree with that kind of an argument. But remember, the enemies of your enemies are not necessarily your friends. Okay, right? Pantheists are the enemies of materialism. And the materialists are our enemies. I mean intellectually now. But that doesn't mean the pantheists are our friends. They're not. All right, anything else on this? Yes. Yeah. And he would constantly give him this language he would say where emotion wasn't emotion, which we would talk about it, and call it a thing field. So they kind of hold Peter's thing, but how important is Peter's definition of spirit? Oh, it's vitally important. That's why you have to be careful of Wittgenstein, because the whole idea of a language game really throws you off the scent. What you need to do to communicate with someone is clarify your terms and what you mean by the terms and then proceed in your argument from there. And just to say, well, you have your language game and I have my language game, and they're incommensurable. It's really the problem of contextualism we dealt with before. If you have two rational people who speak the same language and you define and illustrate your terms, you can go to town with an argument. You don't have to worry about their language game and your language game. Now, some people give this argument, I'm going to be very brief on this, I'm already way behind, that talk about an immaterial substance is a kind of category confusion. It's, to use a Wittgensteinian phrase, language gone on holiday. That we're using language in ways that leads us astray. So we think that there's an immaterial thing when there isn't. It's just a person. And you're sort of taking a slice of the person and making it immaterial. But I think if we define our terms carefully and we talk about the discrepant properties between mind and matter, you've got a clear dichotomy and you've got an argument for dualism.